I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, why chefs were white and why birds were considered the best meat during the Renaissance. Don't forget Mother's Day. Jacques Pepin calls in with some advice for those serving their moms tomorrow. Also, look at the farmers' market movement and how it's changing the way food is bought, sold, and eaten in this country. I'll do some science experiments with kitchen gadgets. But first, let's go to the exploding Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We are happy to have lots of cherries back in the market, and we're talking now with John Barbagelata, who comes down from Stockton. He makes his annual pilgrimage during cherry season. It's an 8-hour drive. It's a long way to go to get down here with these cherries. Tell us, John, what kind of cherries you have now, and tell us what the cherry season's looking like. I guess it looks pretty good this year.
It looks real good, unless, heat's no good. We've had two real hot days. And it looks like we might have a shortage of help this year, too.
Oh, and why is that?
Well, nobody can get across the border anymore.
Oh, really? And that's affecting you up there?
Yeah, it's affecting everybody.
Really? Okay. And what variety of cherries have you got now? These are early cherries.
These are called the Berlats. Then next week we'll probably still have some more Berlats and Tartarian. Then we'll have the Bings and the Rainiers for 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay, and what is characteristic of a Berlat? What do they taste like? What do they look like?
Berlat, it looks good. It's got good color. It's a little softer than your Bings or Rainiers. Other than that, for making pies or eating, it's a beautiful cherry.
And how are you doing up there with the bees?
In the cherries, we don't have a problem with the bees. It seems like the almond growers are the ones that are having problems with, and they pay about $100 a hive, where we pay $16 for cherries. That's a big difference.
So you actually rent hives for $16 each. Oh.
Yeah, for cherries. Yeah.
And then the Rainiers, which are later, those are those wonderful yellow and red cherries, right?
They're yellow with a reddish blush.
Right. And how long are you going to be in? I mean, if the heat, you know, doesn't hurt you too much.
Last year we were here for 6 weeks, and we're shooting for the same amount of time. Normally, cherry season goes from Mother's Day to Father's Day as a rule of thumb.
Oh, that's okay. That's easy to remember. Well, we're looking forward to the Bing. I guess everybody can't wait for the Bings, but these Berlats today are delicious.
No, they got good flavor. Yes, really they do. We can get them harvested. It should be a good cherry year.
Fantastic. All right, John. Well, thank you. And how much are they going for?
They're going for $5 a basket, which are 1 pound, maybe a hair over, or 2 for $9.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was John Barbagelata, and he's a cherry grower. He comes down from Stockton. He's been coming, it's like the swallows at San Juan Capistrano. He comes back every year to the same place at the Santa Monica Market. And he's got some wonderful cherries, and we're looking forward to a really good cherry year this year. We're visiting now with Fitz Kelly, who is our annual fruit harbinger. He's well known for his eclectic variety of fruit and his wonderful, helpful staff. And tell us, Fitz, your table is loaded. What is early and what have you got that's good?
Today we have Mayfire nectarine, which is superb. It's an early, full-flavor nectarine, which means it has acid and it has the sugars, which give it that normal nectarine flavor.
And that's a yellow nectarine.
It's a yellow, full-flavor nectarine, so it's a variety that you can cook with.
And Mayfire is an older variety, and it's been around, and it is just a naturally occurring early nectarine, right?
To the best of my knowledge, it's been around probably 25 or 30 years at least.
Okay.
But there are other varieties out there which are maybe prettier, maybe larger, but they don't taste as good.
Okay, because we're all about the flavor.
That's what we're about.
Okay, and you've got one kind of fruit here. It's in a little clear plastic clamshell. It looks like it's you're treating it like like it's very precious. What is that?
That is an aprium. It looks like an apricot, but it has some plum in it. It has a slightly different color. And it has a combination of flavors, mostly apricot, but then you have a texture of plum with it. And it's a pretty good eating one.
Yeah, it's like an apricot with character.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's not a boring piece of fruit.
Right. That's why we trust you.
Okay.
Okay, what's over there?
So over there we have a yellow peach called Debutante. And it's another full flavor one. And so it has the acids and the sugars in combination. So it's a good eater and it's a good cooker. This year is probably going to be second in flavor to 2004, which was a bellwether year. It was spectacular. season all year long with fruit flavors. This is looking like it's probably going to be right behind 2004.
All right, and you will be here. You have this endlessly changing variety of produce you're going to be bringing over the next month or so, 2 months.
3 months.
3 months. And yep. We'll just have to just check back every week and see what's new.
That's fine. We're going to have a whole range of white nectarines, white peaches, sugar lips, Carmen Mirandas, and then a lot of pluots and plumcots and all those kinds of things. It'll be fun.
It'll be really fun. And your stand is well-staffed. Your employees are fun to talk to, and so are you. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Come back.
We will. We'll be back later in the season. That was Fitz Kelly, and he's back, and he's got all his great varieties of early fruit. And we're happy to get a good start to the fruit season. One of the great things about these apriums that people are bringing in now, it's an early apricot-type fruit, and the farmers have been listening to the customers long enough to know that nobody appreciates an early apricot if it has no flavors. So the farmers have switched over to these apriums, so you're getting sort of the benefit of an apricot with lots of flavor. Of course, the really popular Blenheim apricot is a late apricot, and that won't even be here until end of May, early June. So the early fruit is getting more and more flavorful. We're very grateful to our farmers for working so hard to treat us well and bring us good-tasting fruit. We also have these wonderful, switching to vegetables, we have the wonderful yellow wax beans now, green beans and yellow beans, which haven't been very much in evidence here since Thanksgiving. So now we're getting back into beans, another good sign that summer is coming, and just lots of good reasons to come down here to the farmer's market and look around. And of course, the fruit is changing weekly, so you got to check that out too. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In the old days, people bought their food at central markets from those who grew or produced the food. Then supermarkets happened, and convenience was traded for a close relationship with farmers and with the seasonality of food. But modern-day farmers' markets are bringing that old-world flavor back. When Good Food returns, I'll talk about the state of farmers' markets and whether they can continue in our globalized economy. Ago, I was on a panel about the future of farmers markets, along with Russ Parsons, writer from the LA Times, and Howell Tumlin, executive director of the Southland Farmers Market Association, which happens to be the largest trade association of certified farmers markets in California. The headline of Rush's article, Farmers Market, a victim of its own success, seemed to touch off a lot of conversation in the food blogosphere and amongst farmers and consumers alike. So I thought it'd be a good idea to invite Howell Tumlin to the show to share some of his thoughtful and insightful ideas about the future of farmer direct marketing. Hi there.
Hi.
So in terms of just California, how many farmers markets are there?
Well, there are a little less than 500, and there have been about that number for the last several years. It's actually plateaued at about that number.
It seems like 500 for the whole state of California, considering the number of farmers, is not that many.
It's not that many at all. The California Department of Food and Agriculture estimates that there are 77,000 farmers in California, 60,000 of which could be categorized as small to medium farmers, which, you know, presumably could benefit in some way from having access to a farmer's market. They believe that only 3,000 of those growers actually participate in markets. So that means 95% of the small farmers who could benefit from a farmer's market are not participating or don't have access to a farmer's market. So the logical question is, why aren't there more markets? And there are two answers. One is that it's difficult to start and sustain a market. But the other answer is, and consumers often aren't aware of this, is that the state of California actually invests not a single penny in the promotion and marketing of farmers markets or assistance to farmers markets.
So the organization of which you're the executive director, the Southland Farmers Market Association, really attempts to take on some of the regulatory roles that a government agency might do, correct?
Yes, and we do that in
self-regulation.
We do a lot of self-regulation. We did a lot of work on regulation. It was Southland that basically was instrumental in writing the current statutes that permit farmers markets.
Do other states have agencies that promote farmers markets and help support farmers markets?
They do. Some of the states are very active in supporting markets. The state of Kentucky and New York and some of the southern states actually have grant programs that help communities start their markets. We know in some states the state and local government has helped fund building structures so that markets can come indoors during the winter months. Many of them have active marketing programs where they help a small market simply let the community be aware that they're there as part of a community benefit. We'd love to see that in California, but it's just not been part of the culture here.
It's very interesting. I mean, I think once people find out that such a thing doesn't exist, maybe it will start to percolate. Who knows?
Well, and my view is, in talking with local city councils and county administrators, is that communities prize their farmers markets almost above any other sort of government-supported sanctioned program and activity.
As a public good.
Yeah. But, of course, the consumers and the constituents don't realize that that market is largely put on and funded by the farmers themselves, and that often the city or the county may have staff that are involved in running the market, but other than that are not supporting it directly. Well, we think that this is such a phenomenally successful and important and popular program that, a fraction of a percent of the state budget to help promote and educate and assist communities and just the startup fees, and it's not much, it's just enough to get them started in that first year of operation, could more than double the number of markets available, greatly assist small farmers who are now driving long distances to find a market that they can participate in.
Now let's talk about the driving and the distance, because I think this was at the heart of some comments that you made during that panel.
Yes, we have these wonderful markets that offer us the opportunity as consumers to go and meet the farmer and stop and talk and learn about how the product is grown and the family and the history of the farm. It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for all of us. It is immensely costly for the farmer. I don't know that we often stop and think about the fact that that farmer who's standing across the table from us has probably been in his field the day before, picking the product he's going to sell that day and loading up the truck that night and getting up at 4 a.m. and driving all the way into the city so that he can stand and talk with us.
Instead of farming.
And as I mentioned in the article, it struck me as being like the chef who's in the kitchen, who's a master at his craft or her craft, who's also required to go out and serve the customers and sweep the floor. And because the way the program was set up initially, the only time in the state of California that a farmer is permitted to sell their product directly to us as consumers, instead of going through the packing house and the general industrial pipeline, is when they themselves actually drive into the city, or they get a family member or an employee to drive in the city and literally sell it to us across the table.
There can't be a third party in between this exchange.
That's right. There can't be a third party, and you can't resell something that you've bought from somebody else. And all of that originally made good sense, because I think the program was conceived as being one where farmers would bring the surplus that they had at the end of the year into the city rather than throw it away. Well, today, those same farmers are maybe in three or four markets a week in order to survive, which means they're spending an awful lot more time on the highways than they are farming. And that's a great loss both to the farm and to us as consumers, because a far more efficient system, of course, would be to have the farmer continue what he does best, which is farm.
Do you believe that there should be in Southern California some permanent market spaces that are open 7 days a week, like the farmer's market at 3rd and Fairfax used to be in the 30s?
I believe that that is where we are heading, and that within 20 years, I believe there will be a fixed pavilion where consumers will be able to go and get access to the same kinds of farm fresh products that they can get at the local farmer's market today, 7 days a week. I think that that trend is inevitable.
I love listening to you. You're so articulate on this subject. Thank you very much, Hal. And I look forward to having you back from time to time to talk about other tangential issues of direct marketing with farmers.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Howell Tumlin is the executive director of the Southland Farmers Market Association, an organization dedicated to ensuring the integrity of farmers markets of Southern California. Jonathan Gold, recent Pulitzer Prize winner, is back with me next. Where are we going to eat this week? Stay tuned to find out. It's time once again to get our fabulous suggestion on where to go eat today. Time to have a really delicious lunch. So we're turning to Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the Los Angeles Weekly, writer of many counterintelligence columns, which we eagerly await each week. Where are we going to today, Jonathan?
To the glorious city of San Gabriel.
Gee, what kind of food are we in for?
This would be, I guess, Vietnamese slash Chinese or Chiu Chow style Chinese or ethnic Chinese of some sort of another. But it's a Vietnamese-tinged seafood restaurant called Newport Seafood.
That sounds wonderful.
Newport Seafood is incredibly crowded, and it's cash only, and there's always lines out the door, and they won't let you reserve. And what everybody goes for is the house special lobster.
And why?
Because the house special lobster is fried with just hugely immoderate amounts of garlic and chilies and pepper. And it is crunchy and is delicious, and the garlic and the chilies go into every single crevice of it, and you rip it apart with your hands, and it gets all over your shirt, and you have a little chili beard at the end of it. But, man, that lobster is good.
That sounds wonderful. So since we know it's going to be the centerpiece of our little feast, what do you like to order that sort of works around that?
They have sautéed spicy clams. Everybody likes spicy clams with basil, and they're very good there. They have a kind of sautéed ground chicken dish, also very spicy, that will remind you of a Thai basil chicken, maybe, that is served with leaves of iceberg lettuce. So you put the spicy chicken in the cold lettuce leaf and you eat it, and it's very refreshing and delicious.
What about veggie dishes or any interesting rice combos?
The pea sprouts is a pretty automatic order there. The very young pea plants sautéed with lots and lots of garlic. I don't know about rice combos. The basic rice combo there is rice. But
and actually, I guess if you're going to be eating copious amounts of really spicy garlicky lobster, you might want simple plain rice.
Yeah, but they do a really good version of the either Vietnamese or Cambodian specialty, depending on who you're talking to, called Lok Lok, which is beef sautéed with a lot of things, including ketchup and black pepper and garlic and other things. And it comes out like lacquered in this incredibly savory goo, and it's good.
Ooh, savory goo. That sounds wonderful.
And they have a minor subspecialty in gooey duck, what they call elephant clams, which are either served raw or they're simply stir-fried, or you can order it two ways, in which case you get the guts fried with stuff and returned to you in sort of a, I don't know, fried gut combo. Tasty, though.
Gotta go for that.
And then, of course, you order the lobster, which is sold by the pound, and they're giant lobsters. The minimum they'll sell you is 5 pounds.
And since this is a cash-only place, give us an idea of how much we should be carrying.
If you're going to get the lobsters average about $60, $70, and up if you have a lot of people.
So when you try and figure how much lobster you want for, let's say, a group of 6 people, what do you order?
It'll probably end up being like a 7-pound lobster, a big lobster. But I've got to say, I've gone in there with just my wife, and we've polished off a 5-pounder, and it's not like there was anything left over.
Do you usually go for lunch or for dinner?
I've gone for both, and it's good both ways. They close a little bit earlier than you might want, which is to say 10. Something about a big plate of spicy lobster is something you want to like enjoy after midnight, I think.
Yeah.
When you're already drunk. But
so give us the name and the address.
The name of the restaurant is Newport Seafood, and it is 835 West Latunas Drive in San Gabriel.
And how long could we usually expect to wait for a table?
It depends when you go. If you go on a weekend night, maybe 45 minutes. If you go for lunch, you'll probably get right in.
Cool. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold just won a Pulitzer Prize for Criticism for his weekly writings in the LA Weekly. You can catch him each week in the Weekly. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to hear his past recommendations on good food. It's Mother's Day tomorrow. If you've got a special mom in your life, nothing says love like home cooking. I'll be back with celebrated food personality, chef and author Jacques Pepin. He's got some good ideas for ways to show your love. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. We all have moms, and their influence on us is fundamental, essential. They birth us, feed us, comfort us, care for us. If we're very lucky, they share their kitchen with us and transmit a love of food and its preparation. With me this morning is culinary icon Chef Jacques Pepin. His latest book is Chez Jacques, Traditions and Rituals of a Cook. In the new book, he goes back to his earliest memories of home and cooking with his mother. It's so wonderful to have you here with us this morning.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
So was your mom a stay-at-home mom or a working mom?
Oh, working mom. Certainly. My mother took into the habit of buying a little restaurant, which was all run down, and building it up and selling it and buying another one. My father was a cabinet maker by trade, so it was really my mother running the business. And even though I left home when I was 13 years old, home at that point was a restaurant. So as far as I can remember, from age 5 or 6, I was in a restaurant helping in one way or the other. So she was a great influence on me.
Did she actually cook in the kitchen, or did she move?
Oh, yes. She didn't have money to hire a chef. She was the chef in the kitchen running. Not only that, maybe the most important part, because it was a very inexpensive bistro type of restaurant. What we did was to go to the market, and before going to school in the morning, my brother and I would walk the market along the Saône River in Lyon, which is about close to a mile long, and she would price and buy on the way back, buying like a case of tomato and a case of zucchini, which were slightly soft, and she knew the guy had to get rid of it and trying to get it for a better price for a restaurant. So the buying was very, very important. And then the cooking also, of course.
Give us an idea of some of her dishes.
Well, the crepe that I'm doing, you know, in my book, you can go on cookforthecure.com, and there is a recipe for those crepes I have in the book. Was probably one of her standard things, as well as apple tart. And I have a gratin dauphinois, which is a scalloped potato with milk and cream and garlic. That's one of her classic too. And I have another dish with chicken and morel. That's one of her dish too. So, you know, usually very simple, straightforward, tasty, comfort type of food, you know.
So share with us the crepe recipe.
The best way is to do it in the food processor. You put a cup of flour and about a couple of eggs with it. You add a good cup of milk to it, a dash of salt, a dash of sugar for color, and you pulse that in your processor, a few seconds, and it's done. You don't even have to let that thing, the batter, rest, like many recipes says. I use a little bit of oil I put in it, you know, a no-flavor oil like canola oil. And then you go directly into a non-stick pan and make crepe. It takes about 30 seconds on each side. Very easy to do and just fresh out of the skillet. You know, you put jam in it. That's how my daughter loved it. That's how I had it when I was a child, you know. My mother always made jam, you know, with apricot or strawberry. And in the crepe, which is still hot, warm, you know, you spread out your jam and you roll it or fold it and eat it just right out of the skillet. That's the best way to enjoy crepe, you know.
That sounds like a wonderful Mother's Day brunch dish.
Yes, it is a great Mother's Day dish to do for your mother or your grandmother or your child or your friends, anyone. It's good to cook together, you know, and sit down around the table and eat and share a story. I have many stories like that in the book. Actually, I have five or six essays also that I wrote because I feel that around-the-table conversation is very important, sometimes as much as the food.
Yeah, absolutely. The food becomes a vehicle for the communication.
Exactly. And unless you do that, you never speak to your kids or to anyone. You know, so I've been married 41 years, and I don't remember one time that I didn't sit, you know, at the table with my wife and at night, and we share a bottle of wine and the meal. You know, we've always done that, and we still will do that until we go to the other world.
Once you started having some success in the kitchen when you had finally grown away from your years of apprenticeship, your mother must have just been incredibly proud.
Yes, I think that she was. I mean, she used to love to come to the United States. She doesn't now. She's still alive, but she's 92, and she's too old, but she used to come here. And one time, she was interviewed by someone who said, well, how do you compare your cooking to the one of your son? And she said, well, in translation, she said, well, I am a seamstress, really, and is involved with haute couture. So that's not a reaction. It sounds very good.
That's so wonderful. Tell us a little bit about the Cook for the Cure.
Well, Cook for the Cure, you know, is a very important program for breast cancer for women. KitchenAid, who started that, has raised over $5 million already for this. And if you go on cookforthecure.com, it tells you how to do a dinner cooking for the cure. That is, you invite people to your house and they pay, and you raise money for breast cancer. It's a very important program.
I have to tell you that this latest book, Chez Jacques, may turn out to be my favorite book of yours.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's very intimate. You've shared a lot of yourself in this book.
It is. It's a visual autobiography.
Well, thank you so much. I know you're very, very busy with this new book and your PBS show. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll see you.
Chez Jacques is the latest book from Jacques Pepin. Nothing may say love like a home-cooked meal, but nothing says food like Jacques Pepin. I've got the recipes we talked about online at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you're not comfortable in the kitchen, any cooking can feel like an experiment. Next on Good Food, I've got some real experiments that you can play around with using ordinary kitchen items. Science. That's coming up next. Muller began his career as a geologist. He got into science education because, as I love that he says this, he was yearning for a more confined environment. Passionate about making science real for children, Eric is now science educator at the Exploratorium Teacher Institute. His book, While You're Waiting for the Food to Come, a Restaurant Science Activity Book, is, I have to say, the worst thing to happen to restaurants since sliced bread. Being the victim of many science experiments at my own restaurant. Now, having said that, I'm sitting here in the studio with a lot of very scary things to have in a studio. So tell me, Eric, what I'm going to do, for example, with this turkey baster and the water.
Oh, the turkey baster. Well, we're going to make music with our turkey baster.
Okay.
Well, at least hopefully we can call it music when we're done. Okay, this is what I want you to do. You have your supplies down there in L.A., and I have my supplies over here up here in San Francisco. And my turkey baster is a clear turkey baster. Do you have a clear one?
No, mine is metal.
Okay, well, that's going to work out okay. But what you want to do is you want to fill up your turkey baster so the bulb of the turkey baster is totally filled with water. A clear one, it's a little bit easier to tell, but you should be able to do it. So I'm going to take mine, and I'm going to fill it up.
It is. It's full.
Whoop. I'm going to do mine, too, on this end. Yeah.
Now, what do I do once it's full?
Okay, you ready for this?
Yeah.
So I'm going to forget the turkey baster just for a second. I have a bottle over in front of me.
I have a bottle, too.
Oh, you do?
Uh-huh.
So if you blow across the top of a bottle, go ahead, blow across the top.
I'm not as practiced as you.
Yeah. So it turns out...
Ooh, that
when
was
you
a
blow,
good one.
That was very good. So it turns out when you blow across the top of a bottle, you make vibrations in the air, and depending on the length of your bottle, you make a different pitch. So it turns out you can do all that with a turkey baster. So this is what I want you to do, Evan. I want you to blow across the very top opening of your turkey baster, just like you did with your bottle there, and as you're blowing, squeeze your bulb at the bottom and see what happens. I'm going to try it from my end, too.
Oh, yours is so much better than mine. That's not fair.
Just more practice. I'm first turkey baster in the orchestra up here.
I mean, this is like a piccolo. Okay, now I really...
If you go too high up on it, you get a little bit of squirt.
I'm like the bass. Have you ever done this with a room full of people?
You know, I have done it with a room full of people, but I've never done this in a restaurant. I haven't ever told anyone to go back and pick up the turkey baster. There's great science in it.
What's the science?
And the science is basically as you squeeze the bulb, the water level goes up and it goes down. And depending on the length of the column of air, it changes the pitch. And your turkey baster, you change the column of air, you change the resonance column. You change how the stuff vibrates in there.
I'm no good at this. Give me something else to do I could have more success with.
Okay.
Now, so I understand I'm going to bend water with my head.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what you're going to do. So on this activity over here, you're going to need three styrofoam cups. And
check.
On one of the cups, you're going to fill it up with, maybe half, three quarters full of water. And you might have to get help with this one.
Okay, I have several assistants waiting.
Okay, I have several assistants. That's great. So what you're going to do next is you're going to take a toothpick and you're going to shove it right into the bottom of your styrofoam cup, but you're going to leave it there. And it's going to act as a plug. So pop it in. So what you want to do is you want to get an assistant, and they're going to take a styrofoam cup and they're going to rub it on their nice, dry, clean hair. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm assuming you're holding the cup with water. What you're going to do is you need to put another cup underneath it because you need to dribble this into another cup. And you're going to pull the toothpick out and you're going to let it dribble straight down into your cup. Mine is dribbling in.
Yep, mine's dribbling.
Okay, and you want to lift your cup up so that you have a nice straight stream dribbling in there.
Okay.
And where your assistant rubbed her styrofoam cup, she's going to put that area of the cup, not touching, but right next to that stream of water, and
look, watch what happens. Look, it attracts it. I see it's bending. It's bending.
You got a good bend going on there?
Yeah, it's bending.
Excellent. So it turns out that water is a bent molecule, and it's also polar. So one side of a water molecule is positive, and the other side of it is negative. And when you rub the styrofoam cup on your hair, you make a static charge on it. So what happens is when you bring your charged cup next to that dripping polar molecule, it attracts it. It bends it towards the cup. It's kind of amazing. And it just so happens that polarity of water helps things dissolve in cooking. It helps you make salt water. It helps flavoring is dissolve in water. And it helps in human beings and animals and everything else. It helps make life possible, the fact that water is a polar molecule.
The Exploratorium in San Francisco is where Eric Muller is the science educator. He's got this great book called While You're Waiting for the Food to Come, Experiments and Tricks That Can Be Done at a Restaurant. There's pictures of me on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood, doing some of these experiments. In the Renaissance, birds were the meat of choice. Why? because they flew, and so they were closer to the heavens than other animals. I'll be back next on Good Food to see why chefs wear white in the kitchen and what Leonardo da Vinci had to do with the way we eat. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food. Centuries after his time, Leonardo da Vinci still fascinates us with his extreme facility on a wide range of subjects. Artist and painter, scientist and engineer, the man could also cook. Dave DeWitt, an author, was inspired to write Da Vinci's Kitchen when he found that mainstream biographies of his life missed any mention of his diet or that of Renaissance Italy. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Let's start, I guess, with just a little overview of what people's diets were like during the Renaissance.
Basically, it was wine and bread is what they were eating. And there was a study done of a Pope's school in Provence around 1365, and they found out that the purchases that the school was making, 41% were wine, 32% were bread, and the wine was being consumed as much for the wine and its intoxicating purposes as for the fact that water was not very clean and pure.
Now, was the wine served full strength or was it diluted with boiled water or something else?
It was diluted, and the water was, yes, you're right, it was usually boiled. There was also a class structure around which wines were consumed later on in the Renaissance, with the white wines and what we would call now the blush wines for the upper class and red wines for the lower classes. And this all had to do with a system of viewing foods whereby certain ones were thought to be more pure than others. The closer the meats were to heaven, the more popular they were. For example, fish were not so much popular, but birds were considered to be the ultimate meat of the Renaissance.
Because they flew around in the sky.
Right, and they were closer to heaven.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, let's talk about for a minute Da Vinci himself as a cook. When you say he was a cook, do you mean he like cooked for himself and friends, or did he actually cook on a more elaborate scale?
Actually, Da Vinci was a producer of spectacles and banquets and that sort of thing, but he did not really participate in them. But when I started studying this, I went back to Da Vinci's own notebooks to find out what he had written about food, and there was not very much meat purchased. This led to a lot of people thinking that Da Vinci later in his life became a vegetarian, and most of the biographers of Da Vinci now think that he was a vegetarian, which was extremely unusual in Renaissance Italy, that's for sure.
Being in a kitchen in those days must have been pretty dirty in that all of the fire that was used for cooking was wood fires. Were there any things that we use now that were developed during that era to help with sanitation?
Well, the kitchens had to be kept clean, of course, and one way to find out what was dirty and what was not dirty would be what rubbed off on you when you were in the kitchen actually working. And so the tradition of wearing whites in the kitchen is thought to have originated in the Renaissance in these kitchens.
Now, what were some ingredients that we would find during that period that were used in great abundance?
During the Renaissance, there were new foodstuffs that were introduced into Italy that radically transformed the food of Italy. This happened twice, once during the Renaissance and then once after Columbus. And the first wave of new foods were rice, which came from the Middle East. And then, of course, durum wheat, the hard wheat, which is used to make pasta. And that was transforming the entire cuisine of Italy, because you could now make this pasta that could be dried and thus stored. Another substance that was brought from the Middle East that radically transformed Renaissance diets was sugar. Before then, it was honey that was used as a sweetener, and it was so popular that elaborate sculptures were made for these banquets, sugar sculptures.
So interesting. I know that Da Vinci was constantly fiddling with inventions. They sort of spanned from the mundane to like the just incredible, his flying machines, double-hulled boats, and things that actually couldn't be produced until there were the proper materials to produce some of his designs. But talk to us about a couple of the inventions for the kitchen.
He had two devices for turning meats on a spit, and sort of rotisserie devices. And one of them used a counterweight that was lowered by a rope wrapped around a cylinder. And the second one was even more ingenious because it used the power of heated air. And it's the first appearance in history of an air screw, it's called. Rising heated air in a chimney turned the vaned turbine, which turned the gears and the spit over the fire.
Because of this idea that he was a vegetarian, I would imagine that during that period of time that was seen as rather suspect. Was he thought of in a strange way because he was a vegetarian?
Da Vinci got away with a lot of things that many people would not have gotten away with. And so his homosexuality and the fact that he was a vegetarian were sort of blinked at and ignored because he was such a favorite of the Sforza court in Milan, especially. But some people have suggested that God had given mankind ruling over all the animal kingdom, and it was thought to be blasphemy not to eat meat. But Da Vinci got away with it.
He lived to be 67 years old, which at the time was nearly twice the average lifespan. Did he have a philosophy of how to live life to maintain health?
Yes. In his notebooks, he wrote a poem, sort of a prescription for life. And he says, if you want to be healthy, observe this regime. Do not eat when you have no appetite. Chew well, and whatever you take into you should be well cooked and of simple ingredients. Beware anger and avoid stuffy air. Make sure you do not sleep at midday. Let your wine be mixed with water. Take a little bit at a time, and neither delay nor prolong your visit to the toilet. And rest your head and keep your mind cheerful and avoid wantonness and keep to this diet. And he wrote that in 1515.
Good advice now, most of it, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Oh, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Da Vinci's Kitchen, A Secret History of Italian Cuisine, is Dave DeWitt's book. Speaking of Italian cuisine, next I'll catch up with Mark Schatzker. He's been traveling across the globe the slow way, without use of airplanes or helicopters. I found him in a hotel in Italy. I'll ring him next when Good Food returns. In March of 2007, writer Mark Schatzker began traveling around the world the slow way. The rules of his trip? He can take any form of transportation he chooses, as long as it's not a plane or a helicopter. And there was one catch. He had to complete his circumnavigation in 80 days. Welcome to Slow Travel, the idea that a journey isn't about just going from A to B, but it's about savoring, seeing, smelling, feeling, and of course, tasting every point in between. We've been occasionally finding Mark along his journey, and we've lucked out to find him in Italy today. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm so good, but not as good as you, I'm sure. Where are you calling from?
Right now, I'm in the north of Italy, just towards the Swiss border.
Does that mean that you've gone from the south up?
Yes. I've eaten my way north.
When you first arrived in Italy, it must have been quite strange since it's not quite as exotic as Mongolia. What was your reaction when you first arrived in Western Europe?
My first reaction was I was totally caffeine-addled because I moved from tea culture back into coffee culture and was just drinking way too much of it, and I couldn't sleep, and I was agitated, and I couldn't keep my hands still. But once I started eating, things started to improve steadily.
Did you have a family adopt you?
Basically, I guess something like that happened. I found an agriturismo in a small area of Italy called Cilento. I phoned them up. I phoned up a bunch, but this is the best one. It's run by a woman and her family. She was taught how to cook by her grandmother, by her mother. She can't even really tell you how to cook, she says, because she says it would be like trying to tell you how to talk. It's just something she knows by instinct. So I called her. I said, can I come and stay with you for a couple days? She said, of course. And I said, can I just watch you cook? So that's what I did. I watched her cook, and I ate. And I learned a few things, too.
Now, the Cilento, what region of Italy is that in?
I believe technically it's in Campania. It's kind of next to Calabria, and it's south of Naples.
You have those great regions of really rustic sausages and a little bit of spicy food and lots of homemade pasta.
Exactly. And each little village has its own recipe, and they will all tell you that theirs is better than the next village over.
When you told them you wanted to just hang out and eat, did they take you really literally? Like, did they, for example, did they wake you up first thing in the morning and drag you out of the house on an excursion?
That's exactly what they did. This was to be my slow day because it's slow travel, and I thought, well, I should spend one day not moving. I ended up doing a lot of moving. My slow day, I got up at 7:30. We got in the car, drove into the hills, stopped in this little village called Valle d'Angelo, and picked up this guy. He took us even further into the hills to his in-laws. They live in a tiny little town called Pruno, which got electricity, I think, 5 years ago. His in-laws, Francesco and Maria. Francesco is 81, and Maria is 76. Francesco learned to drive when he was 67. So we paid them a visit, and it was just kind of everyone brought out their own sausages, and we started eating. And there was cheese, there was sheep's milk cheese, pecorino, there was a cow's milk cheese made from the milk of the Podolica cow, which grazes in the mountains, basically. You can't really drive without stopping every 5 minutes because of all these cows.
I know that you have this steak fetish, we might say, and you're on the hunt for interesting and delicious naturally ranched Italian meats. Did you get to do that in this particular area?
Yes, the night before, we paid a visit to the local butcher, a guy named Luigi, a very friendly guy, and he had a big loin of Podolica beef. Podolica is one of the authentic races of Italian cattle. Italians are very particular about their beef breeds. But it gets short shrift. Everyone's always raving about Chianina and Maremma. And I thought, well, I'd really like to try Podolica, and I did. And it's very tasty. It has a really, it was interesting. I talked to Tilda about it. This is the woman who ran the agriturismo. And I said, how would you describe the flavor? And she said, it has the true taste of meat. It had quite a beefy flavor, not gamey, but intense and very tasty.
When you went from the mountains, you're now in the mountains, you're having homemade pasta. And by the way, what kind of pasta did she make that she tried to teach you?
Oh, she taught me how to make fusilli, which isn't anything like the fusilli that we think of, which is kind of the dried twirl. This is fresh fusilli. And basically, she made a fresh pasta dough, rolled it into a little rope, kind of, and then cut it into about one-inch sections. And then she would stick something like a shish kebab skewer into it and then roll the pasta around the shish kebab skewer. So it was this little hollow, ragged tube of pasta. I tried to make it, and I failed. Mine was always stuck. I just couldn't get it, off.
Your hands are too warm.
Is that what it was? But her hands were warm, too. I tried. It just wouldn't work. And then her daughter, Vonda, came in, and she tried it. First shot, it worked. So I think it has something to do with being Italian.
After leaving the hills of the south, did you go to that beautiful coastline?
Yes, I went to the Amalfi Coast.
And I understand that you did a bit of kayaking.
Yeah, the idea was to sea kayak the Amalfi Coast. And people who've been following the blog will know that I had a terrible disappointment in Mongolia. I brought a fly fishing rod with me, a collapsible fly fishing rod that has, I think it comes in 7 pieces, and I only brought 6 of them with me. So very kindly, one of the people who works for Orvis, which is the company that makes the fly fishing rod, sent me one. I got it in Italy, and when we went kayaking, I strung it up, I started fishing, and we were on our second day, and we just rounded this point. There was this kind of this old lighthouse on the point that looked like a castle. If it wasn't medieval, it certainly looked that way, and I got a hit. I caught a mackerel, reeled it in, bonked it on the head, and then we kayaked to the closest village we could find, which was called Fiore, which is in this little tiny gorge. You can't even get to it by car. You have to walk down a huge number of steps to get to it. there's a little restaurant there. We walked in holding a dead fish and said, would you cook this for us? And this wonderful Italian woman named Nicoletta said, of course, took it in the kitchen, chopped its head off, chopped it into little pieces and cooked it in crazy water, which is the Southern Italian recipe of olive oil and garlic and tomatoes.
Acquapazza.
Yes, acquapazza.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Mark Schatzker. He's been working on an article for Condé Nast. He's been slow traveling around the world in 80 days, eating all along the way. For updates and pictures of Mark's travels, you can read his blog. I've got links to it on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. You know that adage about blackbirds and pie? I'll tell you where that got started. That's coming up next on Good Food. Things both good and bad have come out of the new interest in food that Food TV has brought us. One of the good things is the new academic interest in food, and of course an ever-increasing awareness that we are what we eat. As food is becoming ever more a focus of study, it makes sense that there would be reference books for food. So it was only a matter of time for the Oxford Companion series to focus its attention on American food and drink. It's here in all its eclectic, panoramic hugeness. So to help us graze on this giant meal is the editor of the tome, Andrew Smith. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
This is the kind of book that I like to just flip open to a page, any page.
Yep.
And so while I was doing that when I first got it, I found myself looking at food humor.
I think food humor is wonderful. I don't think it's done well enough in the United States today.
Really? Why do you say that?
No. People take food so seriously.
It's
you know?
True.
And
you just sit
back and say, it's really funny if you start looking at what we do. And looking at what we do is funny. Looking what somebody else does and making fun of it is not funny. So I think that's part of the problem.
So I'm going to choose a subject. Flying pies.
Flying pies are good.
Now, I understand that this is where 4 in 20 blackbirds baked in a pie comes from.
Well, that's the statement, but I found that's what we stated in the companion, and that's accurate. I've also found references to blackbirds actually in pies and in the 17th century in English cookbooks. So I know that sounds strange, but it really at least goes back 400 years.
Actually cooked as a food?
It was prepared as a food, and as you well know, food then as today is partly entertainment. And the goal was to literally open up the pie and have the blackbirds fly out. So they weren't cooked there particularly, but it was part of the enjoyment of having a meal and being surprised, which is also part of what we do today.
You'd have the food police people at the door if you did that now.
Well, could be, but that's part of the lack of food humor that exists today in America. I'm not arguing for it. I'm just simply saying that food historically has been an entertainment, and it is today too, but not quite the same way of actually putting blackbirds into a pie coffin and then opening it up at the right time. But in the same cookbook, they have a complete boat that goes on the centerpiece with cannons that fire off that are supposed to fire during the meal. So again, It's food's entertainment. It's fun.
Talk to me a little bit about food-based humor and its evolution, some aspects that you learned during your research that particularly appeal to you.
Well, I mean, there were lots of jokes, lots of ones which we didn't put in. But you heard about the man who went into a cafe and asked whether they had any chicory. And the waitress said, sure. And he said, well, can you bring it to me? And she said, okay, fine. So she brought out some chicory. And then he said, well, do you have any more chicory? And she said, sure. And he said, well, can you bring it all out here for me? And she said, fine. So she went and got back into the kitchen, brought back all the chicory. He said, now this all the chicory that you have? She said, yeah. And he said, now I'd like a cup of coffee.
oh,
I love
I thought that was funny when I first heard it. And but that's a 19th century joke. And,
really?
And yeah, absolutely. It's not a 20th century joke at all. And it goes back to saying, what is coffee? And today we think of it as something that comes out of a can or something that comes out of Starbucks or something like that. But the answer is historically coffee was many things and they had many other ingredients added in. And chicory was certainly one.
Now, an offshoot of food humor is food slang, which I really love. I mean, I always love when I meet somebody who has, you know, a food name like Mark Peel, who's a chef here in L.A., chef owner of Campanile. I thought, God, what a great last name for a chef, Peel. And I, of course, grew up in the 50s and loved watching movies in which food was depicted, like Mildred Pierce, and you'd hear all that great diner slang. Share some food slang with us.
Adam and Eve on a raft, which is, of course, poached eggs on toast. Angels on horseback, which is, of course, oysters rolled in bacon served on toast. Belly warmer, a cup of coffee. Bilge water soup. Bossy in a bowl, beef stew.
Bossy in a bowl?
I love it. Don't you?
I would have imagined that would have been something that was based on milk. But no. Oh, that's a brutal one.
How about city juice, water?
City juice is water?
Of course.
Oh, that's so funny. Okay, I have to ask one more question. The California roll.
Yes.
Now, we're Californians. We want to know,
yes,
where did it come from?
The Japanese restaurants opened in America during the 1960s. There were some couple or a decade before that, but most of them had a real problem trying to sell raw fish. And you grew up in the 50s, and so did I. Anybody who came by and said, you got to eat some raw fish, you would have thought they were crazy. So Japanese restaurants had a real problem, and so it happened to be that there were restaurateurs in Los Angeles, California, that said, well, we need to introduce the concept of sushi in a new way. And so they invented the California roll, which is, of course, avocado and a number of different cooked ingredients on the inside. And Americans and Californians in particular ate the California roll and said, this is really good. Now I'm going to really sample something of the hard stuff. And so it really was a quick introduction into sushi for many Americans. And it was the bridge that kind of made it possible for Americans to say, now we can eat raw fish just like the Japanese do.
Well, Andrew, it's really been great talking with you, and I love this book. It's the kind of book I'm going to keep on the side of my bed for years, and every night before I go to bed, I'll just read a few paragraphs.
Well, I hope you're not saying it's going to put you to sleep.
No, it's like that's the moment of pure pleasure reading.
Okay, all right. I feel a lot better now. That's great.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
The Oxford Companion to American Food and Drink is a mighty large tome dedicated to one of my favorite subjects. Andrew Smith is the author and has been my guest. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find every week's show. You can stream Good Food, podcast Good Food, and watch episodes as well. Find it all on kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Chaloner, with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join us next week for another edition of Good Food.